Shalom Aleichem. Welcome to the Yiddish Book Center's Francis Brandt Yiddish Audio Library. The program you're about to hear was recorded at the famed Jewish Public Library in Montreal and remastered and restored by the Yiddish Book Center.
On behalf of the Jewish Public Library, to welcome you to a literary evening, which is the second of a series that the library has entertained for this year and has taken off on an experiment which has thus far met with a great deal of approval on the part of those who attended the first lecture, and I have a feeling that the same kind of approval will come forth from this lecture. And that is, the library would like to introduce our Montreal audience to prominent writers who have their roots in the Jewish community of Montreal. And a few months ago, we had the pleasure of having Mr. Saul Bellows with us. And today, we meet Mordecai Richler. Now, we are doing this because we feel that this is good both for those who read of the works of the writers and also for those who write, because it gives the writers an opportunity to gain perhaps a more intimate, a closer tie with the community and with people in the community in Montreal. A closer tie with the audience. The audience gets to know the writer better, and the writer gets to know his audience better. Tonight, Mr. Richler will be reading excerpts from his latest work, which is in progress, and this is The Horseman of St. Urban Street. And following this reading, he will answer questions that may be put to him by the audience, and questions which will pertain to the process of writing a novel in the ambience of the Jewish community. And Mrs. Ruth Weiss, who is sitting farthest to the right, who, as we know, is a lecturer in English at McGill University and is now a lecturer in Yiddish literature at McGill, and was one of the initiators, one of the prime forces behind the organization of the program of Jewish studies at McGill during this past year. Ruth Weiss will give us an introduction on the author, Mordecai Richler. It is my pleasure this time to introduce Ruth Weiss to you.
In the McGill Daily of Friday, this past week, there were a series of cartoons on prominent Canadians. And I'm sure there were about a dozen prominent Canadians included. And I'm sure it won't be a surprise to anyone here that Mr. Richler was one of those so honored. The cartoon of Mr. Richler is one of a very fierce young gentleman crossing a stream in hip boots. And as he wades across, the caption underneath reads, "Mordecai Richler, disturbing the calm sea of Canadian literature." I think that if this isn't a very accurate description of Mr. Richler's achievement as a novelist, I think it's certainly a rather accurate description of his reputation as a Canadian novelist. When people discuss his work, it's usually in terms of his achievement as a satirist, always as one who is disturbing the calm sea of something or other, either of Canadian literature or of Canadian life, or in the case of our particular community, of the calm Montreal Jewish community. Now, as a satirist, Mr. Richler is usually described in negative terms. He exposes, he tears away, he reveals the glaring discrepancy between our idealized view of ourselves, the idealized view that we try to project to others and sometimes misguided we really have of ourselves, and the more brutal reality of what perhaps we are. And as a satirist, he is not always spoken of very lovingly. I had the experience several years ago of introducing the book, The Apprenticeship of Dirty Kravitz, to a study group of women. And after presenting some problems connected with this book, the floor was opened for a discussion for questions, as it will be this evening. And the questions that arose at that time are probably very familiar to most of you. And my sense of foreboding tells me that they'll probably be strangely similar to the kinds of questions that may be raised after this evening. They were somewhat as follows. Why is this novelist so negative? Why is he writing here about cripples, psychological cripples and impotent men and spiritual cripples? Why is there so much schmutz? Why is this novel tend to be so anti-Semitic? And more and more questions in this vein. And at the time, and I say this somewhat by way of saying mea culpa, I really took those questions at face value and answered to them, accepting the premise on which they were based. And so one didn't question the fact that this was a negative book, but one simply said, well, isn't in fact this true? Let's take, for instance, the classic sequence of that book. It has become a classic. The book is a classic. It's studied at McGill. It's studied at Sir George. And I think of all the sequences in that book, the bar mitzvah part of it is one of the funniest things that's ever been written about, in Canadian literature. This bar mitzvah sequence, I asked this group of women, isn't it in fact a reality? Isn't the grandfather involved right in saying, listen, you've brought me here to a church, not to a shul? Isn't there in fact a desecration of the bar mitzvah ceremonial going on? And is the novelist not justified? Is he not really to be thanked for exposing our failures in this way? It's just this year that in studying another very great Jewish satirist, Mendel Moicher Svorim, that I've had occasion to think about satire in a different way. Reading an essay on satire written by a critic of the 18th century, I learned from him that satire really isn't written negatively. And I think that what Mr. Sutherland, this critic, has to say is really very relevant in a discussion of Mr. Richler's work. Mr. Sutherland says that satire is in fact always written when there is a conflict of values in the community. And the satirist is not merely tearing down a set of values, but what he is doing is actually reinforcing a set of values that is held by some members of that community. And whereas this might be almost an axiom to some, it was by way of a revelation to me, because I know that in reading Mr. Richler's work, this is often what it has in fact been, not an exposure, but so much as a revelation to myself of things that I knew were wrong, that I knew I was against. But not being a writer, one is not able to express oneself clearly enough. One doesn't even know sometimes where the shoe pinches. And when my friends went out and bought 12 copies apiece of The Adventures, The Apprenticeship of Dirty Kravitz, and sent them out to all their friends, it was not, as I thought at the time, merely because they were sentimental about their experiences in Baron Bing, which this book evoked, but I think it was because of very much the same reasons. The book was a reinforcement of values held, and it was comforting to see that there was someone able to express what was wrong with the community and thereby to express what one felt can be done to improve it. It's the positive qualities of the satirist that I would like to draw attention to, And I would like to say that on behalf of myself, I don't know how many other members of this audience, I'm very grateful to Mr. Richler for performing this very valuable function within the Canadian community, and particularly within the Canadian Jewish community. Mr. Richler's last work, Cocksure, to be very personal, has frightened me dreadfully. If one compares it with The Apprenticeship of Dodie Kravitz, you see that the view of mankind is a much more disturbed one. The book is written in a much more frenetic style. The humor is hardly as funny. And the situations that he exposes and deals with are terrifying, in fact. They're not just worrying, as perhaps they are in The Apprenticeship of Dodie Kravitz, but actually terrifying. And I find Cocksure quite a terrifying book. I must say that it was therefore a relief for me to discover a new writer recently, a writer who also writes under the name of Mordechai Richler. I discovered this new writer, if I may call him a new writer, in the pages of the New American Review, Volume 4. This Mordechai Richler is, of course, very closely related to the old Mordechai Richler, but the style of writing is completely different. This is a very lyrical, very beautiful memoir of Mr. Richler's years in Paris. I must say that I was very touched in reading it. It is a very honest exposure of what he was going through as a novelist then, of his own judgment of himself and his whole circle of friends at that time. And I'd like to say, if I may, that I hope that this isn't the last kind of writing of that kind that you do. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Mordechai Richler, and I think that on behalf of us all, I thank him for accepting this invitation to address us this evening.
I'm going to read an excerpt from a novel in progress. The novel is called St. Urban's Horseman. A word of explanation first. The central character is called Jacob Hirsch. He's in his late 30s. He's a film director from Montreal, living in London. He is on trial at the Old Bailey for a sexual offense. In the excerpt I'm now going to read, Jacob Hirsch stands in the dock of the Old Bailey and in his mind's eye returns to Montreal in the early 50s, to Montreal and New York. Jake's past, which he always took to be characterized by indirection and self-indulgence, could now be seen to have assumed nifty contours, a meaningful shape. Cousin Joey, Dr. Mengele, Harry, all frog marching him to where he now stood so incongruously, stupefied and inadequate, in the dock of courtroom number 1 at the Old Bailey. Yesterday, the case against him had looked shaky, very shaky, and he was sure he would be acquitted. Today, Harry was summoned to the stand for the first time. Harry the idiot. As the clerk brought him the New Testament to swear on, the judge coughed and waved his hands. Religion, he asked. Harry's silence was not merely hostile. It scorched. Are you Jewish? Before Jake's eyes, the ruinously expensive legal advice, the cajoling, the rehearsals, the tranquilizers all went for nothing. For purposes of census, taxation, and pogroms, Harry proclaimed to the somnolent courtroom, I am a Jew. It's the rope, Jake thought. It's the rope for sure. Quite, the judge said, and he called for an Old Testament to be brought to Harry. In the beginning, Jake remembered. Give me one logical reason, he asked his grandfather, why I must always wear a hat. Because, his grandfather replied, if you go without a hat, if you question that, what next? The pit. You see, Jake's father said, you hear? I see, I hear. Gehenna, 1954, Montreal. Jake's mother entered his room without knocking. "You should phone your father to say hello," she said. "I suppose I should." Jake had already been back for a week. "He's so bloated," his mother said. "I saw him on the street. He looks like a frog now." "Where are you going suddenly?" "For a walk," Jake said. "I wouldn't say a word against him," his mother said. "After all, he's your father. You hear?" "Yes." Birds, a sky full of squawking birds. Arrow after arrow of birds, wise birds, fill the autumn sky flying south. And Jake thought, "Wait, wait, I'm coming too, at least as far as New York, as soon as I can raise the fare." Compulsively, without design, he drifted all the way down to St. Urban Street and watched himself amused entering Tansky's Cigar and Soda to phone his father. "You're back," his father said. "Yes." "So what did you accomplish in 2 years in Europe?" "Bupkes." Jake suggested they meet for a talk, and Mr. Hirsch came to fetch him in his battered Chevy. Two more inclement Montreal winters had eaten into the bodywork. It was rusty and rotting. "You might as well know," Mr. Hirsch said, "that according to my insurance policy, nobody under 25 is allowed to drive this car." "I don't even know how to drive," Jake protested, amused. "Did I say you? Nobody said you especially. Montreal's changed. You won't recognize it." "I recognize it," Jake said. "Still a smart guy," his father said. Jake asked his father if they could drive to a delicatessen on the Main, as in the old days. "But nobody goes there anymore," his father said. "It's not the style." Reluctantly, he drove Jake to High's Delicatessen on the Main. Smoked briskets were stacked like loaves in the window, red grizzly beef tongues heaped alongside. Salamis rocked on a line when Jake banged the door shut behind them. The aroma was even more maddeningly appetizing than he had remembered. "It's very nice, this," Jake said, smiling warmly. "What are you talking about? It's a delicatessen, big deal." "No, no, I mean just the two of us going out to eat." "I haven't got any money," his father said. "Who said anything about money?" "I've got a Jewish cold," his father said, "pneumonia." Mr. Hirsch ordered for both of them, two lean on rye, sour tomatoes, and knishes, if they were today's. "What's that you're smoking?" he demanded, irritated. "Gauloise," Jake said. "Feh." "Do you still read Northern Miner?" Jake asked. "Yes, I still read it, so?" "What about your stocks, then?" "What about my stocks? Right off the bat, what about my stocks?" "Calm down, will you," Jake said. "I don't want a penny from you." "The stocks are not so hot," his father said. "I don't understand it, I really don't. Your uncles have such luck on the market, but with me it never works. If people give me tips, it's out of spite. I've lost maybe 1,800 smackaroos, 1,800 in the last 2 years. "That's terrible," Jake said. "I'm sorry." "C'est la guerre." Mr. Hirsch motioned Jake closer. Narrowing his big frightened eyes, he searched out the furthest corners of the delicatessen for eavesdroppers. "I've got one stock." His voice fell to an all but inaudible mumble. "Algonquin Mines." "El what mines?" Jake asked. "Don't say it, Big Mouth." "Say what? I didn't even hear you." "You have to know the name of the mine. If you don't, your heart will stop ticking over." "No," Jake said, "of course not." "I've got an ox day. X Mines," he said, his voice gathering volume and booming like a bowling ball across the delicatessen. "It's just gone from $1.19 to $5.10 in the last week." Immediately, High switched off the automatic meat slicer. At the next table, an old man's spoon clattered in a bowl of kreplach soup. "The trouble is," Mr. Hirsch said, his voice shriveling again, "I bought it at $11.55. As a boy, Jake remembered, he had used to lie in wait for his father with his grammar texts, terrorizing him by demanding help with his homework. Each time Izzy Hirsch flubbed a word or made a grammatical slip, Jake, his manner exultant, had corrected him. "I haven't been a good son," he thought, reaching across the table to stroke his father's cheek. Had anybody seen? Mr. Hirsch, his eyes shooting in all directions, hastily knocked Jake's hand away. "What's that?" he demanded. "Something you learned in Paris? Is that the limey style, maybe?" Too late, he noticed that Jake's eyes were moist. Everything's on me, he added hastily. Today it's Daddy who pays. Jake lit another Gauloise morosely. Well, you're no longer a kid, Mr. Hirsch said, bewildered, his cheeks flaring red. And let's face it, it's turned out you're not such a fart smeller. Smart feller, I mean. But he didn't earn a laugh, not even a smile. All right, he said, that's just enough out of you. Now, what did you want to talk to me about? You didn't come back with the SIF or anything like that. No, Jake said. Mr. Hirsch paid on his way out, scooping up a handful of change. Outside, he screwed up his eyes to glare at each coin before he dropped it into his pocket. Anything wrong, Jake asked. Shh, 1 minute. A couple passed. Then a hawkish old lady hugging a parcel of fish, followed by some teenagers sporting shimmering AZA windcheaters. Finally, they were alone. You see this, Mr. Hirsch said? Yes. It's an American nickel. So, what were you, born stupid? If this nickel was not a Jefferson, but a 1938 Buffalo, with a tiny S and a D, S for San Francisco, D for Denver, it would be worth plenty. Only last summer, Max Kravitz picks up a drunk in his taxi and drives him to Aldo's. The fare is $2.10. The goy hands Max a $4 bill. Yes, a $4 bill, a Bank of Upper Canada note dated December 1st, 1846. You know what that's worth? Oh, Daddy, give up, Jake said fondly. You're never going to be rich. In your books, that's everything, being rich. I'd be your pal then, wouldn't I? We wouldn't have to sneak down to the Maine together after 2 years. We could sit together in a swell restaurant. They have kosher Chinese food now in Snowden. And you wouldn't be ashamed if your hoity-toity friend spotted us. Well, let me tell you this much, not that you listen. What do I know? I'm just your father. Making money isn't everything. The president of the largest steel company in the world, Charles Schwab, he said, numbering him off on a finger, died a bankrupt and lived on borrowed money for 5 years before his death. The man who in 1923 was president of the New York Stock Exchange, Richard Whitney, is still in Sing Sing. The greatest bear in Wall Street, Jesse Livermore, died a suicide. You know what you need? You need a job, self-respect. Rather than drive back with his father, Jake wandered down to St. Urban again. Duty, he remembered, Artie, Stan, Gaz, and me. Everything happened so quickly. One day, Artie, Duty, Stan, Gaz, and Jake were collecting salvage, practicing aircraft recognition, and the next, it seemed, the war was done. Cousins and uncles came home. What was it like over there, they were asked. An education. Is Hitler really dead was what concerned everybody. That and an end to wartime shortages and ration books. One stingingly cold Saturday afternoon, a man came to the door. Leather cap, roomy eyes, an intricately veined nose, battle ribbons riding his lapel. One arm was no more than a butt, the sleeve clasped by a giant safety pin. And with the other arm, the good arm, the man offered a veteran's calendar, the Karsh portrait of Churchill encased in a gold foil V. They're only 50 cents each, he said. No thanks, Mr. Hirsch said. Reproachfully, the man's bloodshot gaze fastened on his battle ribbons. He said, ever hear of Dieppe? Jake looked up at his father imploringly. And did you ever hear of the Better Business Bureau, Mr. Hirsch demanded. Because it so happens they have broadcast a warning for law-abiding citizens not to buy combs or soap from cripples who just claim to be war veterans. Jew bastard, the cripple said. Mr. Hirsch slammed the door. You see what they're like, he said, turning on Jake. You see? But did you see his arm, Jake said. He lost it at Dieppe, maybe. And did you see his schnoz? He's a boozer. The only battle he ever fought was with Johnny Walker. You've got to get up early in the morning to put one over on Izzy Hirsch. From Fletchersfield High School, 3 years after the war's end, Jake went into Sir George Williams College, out of the ghetto into the YMCA. Their lecture rooms were on the first three floors, while the higher reaches of the dreary YMCA building on Stanley Street was choked with transient rumors, mostly big city flotsam, drifters, whose sometimes faggoty presence made a trip to the toilet between Psych 108A and Philosophy 102 something of a risk. There's nothing Jake's mother drilled into him like a university education. Yes, Jake said. It's not what you know, Jake's father corrected her, it's who you know. Yes, again. At college, Jake cultivated a new statesman outlook. He wore a tweed jacket with leather armpits, crammed his shells with penguins, and let his hair grow long. Whenever he could afford it, he ate at Italian restaurants. On each table, there was an empty Chianti bottle plugged with a colored candlestick. Jake recommended Angelo's to an old school friend, Dudy Kravitz. They serve the most exciting scampi, he said. Oi, Dudy said, look at you. Jake's older sister was embarrassed by him and his irreverent friends. Suspicious, hostile, Rivka began to ask what seemed like absurd questions. Do you drink sherry, she asked. Well, sometimes, Jake said, Tio Pepe. He was at the time reading The Quest for Corvo. Aha, and what do you and your long hair friends do until 4 a.m? Read poetry aloud to each other, maybe? Sometimes, Jake said, or we listen to records. Classical records? Well, yes, so. Tell me, are you scared of snakes? She asked. What? Finally, Jake discovered what was behind the inquiry. An issue of Esquire on his sister's dressing table with an article titled, Is Your Kid Brother a Homosexual? His future brother-in-law had given Rivka the magazine. Herky had already suggested that Jake do something about his blackheads before the wedding. It's going to be a formal affair, he said, and you're the best man. I won't pop any during the ceremony, okay? Jake took to walking about the house with his hands held out in front of him, the wrists limp. At the supper table, a couple of nights later, he said to Herky, Be a dear, will you, and pass me another knidge. Merci. Easy there, Herky said. Money. The sky was black with birds going south, and Jake lay smoking on his bed, wondering where he would get the money. He tried Uncle Sam, Wiley Sam, who had awakened early enough one post-war morning to buy up arpent upon arpent of suburbia when it had still been farmland. It's for New York, Uncle Sam. Until I get settled there, I need $250. Who doesn't, Uncle Sam said. You don't. Money, Uncle Sam said. Ah, you've got your health. It's worth a million. I envy you to be your age. 200 would see me through, I suppose, Jake said. I could pay it back within a year. Look at us, Uncle Sam said. You're an intelligent boy. We sit here, friends, family. You want another Ryan Ginger Ale? Take. Who's counting? It's open house here, isn't that so? Then I lend you money, and you tell me I can have it back within a year, right? You've got my word, Jake said. Then, God forbid, a year goes by and you haven't got the money. Then what happens? Tensions, bad feeling. We no longer sit together, my rye and ginger ale between us. But I promise, Uncle Sam. You promise? Who comes to borrow money and says I won't pay you back? It's not my policy to lend. It only makes enemies, especially family. You see my point of view? The sign behind the desk in Uncle Morris's office read, Ali Babi was a fortunate man indeed. He only had 40 thieves to deal with. Uncle Morris said no, he couldn't lend money, not at the moment. So Jake went to see Uncle Lou. I'll come right to the point, Jake said. I need $250. That's some stench of humor you've developed. This is serious, Uncle Lou. I've knocked up a shiksa. Oh my God, I could tell you were in trouble. Just looking at you, I said to myself, the kid's in hot water, a tank full. I've always liked you. Either I raise the money for an abortion, Jake said, or I've got to marry her. $250, Uncle Lou said. That's the size of it. Don't brag, Uncle Lou said. What? A joke. I try to see the humorous side of everything, Uncle Lou said. It's my philosophy. Oh, I see. Listen, Uncle Lou said, my Ida's brother-in-law, the doctor in Hamilton, you remember him, I'm sure, he'll do it for you. It will cost you only 100 tops. I'd hate to have to bargain about a thing like this, Jake said. It's not my nature, Uncle Lou. I understand. I'm the same. I'll phone him myself and settle it for you. Could you let me have 100, then? There's no need, Uncle Lou said. He's into me for more than that. I'll wipe it off his account. Only Uncle Abe was left, scornful Abe, and Jake had no intention of asking him for money. Herky? Maybe. Worth a try, anyway. Jake phoned him and asked if they could meet for a drink. Can do, Herky said, and he drove him to a roadhouse. Jake and Herky did not go directly to their table. Hooking him under the arm, Herky said, "Got to check the cans out first. Come on." Herky manufactured liquid soap and towel dispensers and deodorizing solutions for urinals. He never went to a restaurant or a nightclub or a hotel without first inspecting the toilets and reporting back in full to the table. "It's from the Stone Ages here. You know what they've got in the urinals? Ice cubes." The Roadhouse was not one of Herky's clients. "This isn't a toilet, kid. It's a storage tank for last week's farts. Take a deep breath, kid." "I believe you," Jake said. "It's a shame, a crying shame. You know why, Butt? In their books, the toilets are non-productive units. They don't turn over a profit. But that's short-sighted as all hell, because if a guy comes in here to comb out his hair and gets a whiff of last week's crap, he doesn't complain about the toilet. That would be undignified. He tells everyone the steak isn't juicy. You read me?" "Yeah," Jake said. "Now let's go." Okay, he said, leading Jake to the bar. "But facilities should be spotless, above reproach, like Napoleon's wife. It's the kind of investment that pays off." "God damn it, Herky, you don't have to sell me." "We did a survey," Herky said. "The average guy, if he's in a restaurant or a nightclub and he has to crap, he skips the dessert and cancels the next round of drinks so he can let rip at home. Sorry, what are you drinking?" "Scotch," Jake said. Herky ordered two scotches. "Public toilets," he continued, "have a bad image. Now tell me a toilet's non-productive. I mean, when you add up a year's skip desserts and drinks, well, what's the use of booking Lena Horne for $1 million a week? We made the findings part of our sales kit." "It's a strong argument," Jake said. "Are you rich, Herky?" "It's all tied up." Herky put a hand on his heart. "I'd love to help out, kid, but it's all tied up." "I'm not asking for money. You see," Herky said, "I shovel everything right back into the business. Rivka's very active, you know, socializes like hell. She used to be in cancer, but she didn't care for the kvetchy new president there. So now she's in heart ailments. In fact, as of last week, she's running her own artery. They do a lot of good work, you know." "I'm sure," Jake said. "Hey, tell you what," Herky said, "you want some stuff that I can fix?" "Stuff," Jake said. "It's free. Charna Rosen, you remember her. Well, now she puts out. She'd be glad to see you. She reads Dylan Thomas." "Herky, I'm not interested." "Ah, don't tell me," Herky said. "You're getting it regular. A college boy, an assimilationist. 69. Ooh la la. Well, you don't have to spit on us. Me and Rivka were the nonconformist type." Jake fixed his brother-in-law with an earnest, melancholy stare. "Herky," he said, "I'm glad you said that." "Oh, yeah," Herky said, full of anticipation. "You see," Jake said, "I'm not interested in girls." "What?" "Remember you once put Rivka up to asking me funny questions, like was I scared of snakes?" "Let's get the hell out of here," Herky said, grabbing him. They huddled together in Herky's Chrysler in the parking lot. "You mean to sit there," Herky said, "and tell me you're a fagula?" Jake nodded. "We've been to the YMHA pool together," Herky shouted, shaking a finger at him, "in the old days." "Oh, you filthy bastard." Herky bit his lip. "It would kill Rivka. Hell, if she found out..." "It's no bowl of cherries for me either, you know," Jake said. "Yeah, sure," Herky said. "Look at it this way," Jake said. "You go to a dance at the golf course and feel up Charna Rosen or somebody else's wife, and the other guys just give you a big wink. But if I turned up and wanted to neck with one of the waiters or caddies..." "Listen here, you little son of a bitch." Herky stopped short. He rolled down the window. "Couldn't you see a psychiatrist?" Jake didn't answer immediately. "Well," Jake said, "Rivka says your new rabbi is brilliant, very up to date. Maybe I should ask him for guidance." "I wouldn't if I were you," Herky said. "He's not reform, you know." "Herky, I think it would be best if I left town." "Well," Herky said, starting up the car, "if that's how you feel." "I've been thinking of New York," Jake said. "The problem is I'm broke. I haven't even got enough money for the fare." "We all have our problems," Herky said frostily. "Herky, you don't understand my passions." "Shut up about it, will you? I'm driving." "My passions get out of control. The cops are bound to pick me up one night on the mountain or in Outremont." "You want to borrow money from me," Herky said. "Is that what you're getting at?" "I'd pay you back, honestly, darling," Jake said. "I should break your neck. I should pull you out of the car right here and cut it off for your own protection. $250 would see me through nicely, Jake said. I've always suspected you, Herky said. You know that, don't you? You're brainy, Herky. There's no denying it. Oh, you snake, sewer. You really neck with other guys. Jake blew him a kiss. You take that back. You take that back, you filthy thing. But all the same, he gave Jake the $250. Every autumn since childhood, Jake had watched the birds, the cunning birds, fly south. And this October at last, he was following after, across the border to the sources of light. For his uncle's Miami, the Catskills. For his aunt's, the wonder doctors of the Mayo Clinic. New York, it had always been their true capital. Ottawa, Quebec City, those were bush league towns where you went to pay off a government goy for a contract or a building permit. They were the places the regulations came from, not life's joys. New York, New York. There wasn't a cigar store between Park Avenue and the Main that did not carry the essential New York dailies, the News, the Mirror, and the Daily Racing Form. Ed Sullivan, Bugs Bear, Dan Parker, the Gumps and Smiling Jack, Dorothy Dix, Hedda Hopper, but above all, Walter Winchell. Jake had only been a boy during the war. He could remember signs in Tansky's Cigar and Soda that warned, "The walls have ears, and the enemy is everywhere." He could recall his father and mother, his uncles and aunts, cracking peanuts on a Friday night and waiting for the United States, for those two unequaled champions of their people, Roosevelt and Walter Winchell, to come off it and get into the war. They admired the British. They were gutsy, but they had more confidence in the United States Marines. They could see the likes of John Wayne, Clark Gable, and Robert Taylor making mincemeat of the panzers, while Noel Coward, Laurence Olivier, and the others seen in a spate of British war films had looked all too humanly vulnerable. Like you, they could suffer heartburn, gallstones, and disrespectful children. But Winchell, marvelous Walter, was proof against plain people's ailments. Out there in Manhattan, night after night, he was always ready to award orchids for the best, regardless of race, color, or creed. Ever watchful under a broad-brimmed fedora, Walter Winchell cruised in a radio police car, uncovering America firsters, giving FDR baiters what for, and smashing hate mongers in their lairs. Who was there, if not WW, to tell Mr. and Mrs. America in the evening and all the ships at sea about the Jewish war effort, about Barney Ross, about Irving Berlin and Eddie Cantor, giving so unselfishly of their time and talent, or that the bombardier in the first plane to sink a Nip ship was a Jewish boy, good enough to die for his country, not good enough for some country clubs WW could name. New York was quality, top quality. It sent Montreal Jenny Goldstein and Aaron Lebedoff. When AB's Irish Rose finally reached His Majesty's Theater, and uncles and aunts went not once but twice, the sign outside, a veritable guarantee, read, "Direct from New York." From blessed New York, where Bernard Baruch sat on a bench telling presidents and prime ministers when to buy cheap, when to sell dear. Where Mayor LaGuardia could speak a Yiddish word. Where there were second cousins on Delancey Street or in Brownsville. Where the side-splitting Mickey Katz records were made. Where Pierre Van Passen flew in from to bring forth sobs and donations as he told an SRO audience about the Haganah fighting off Rommel in the desert, sometimes isolated for days and being driven to drinking their own urine. "Piss," his father said. "Is that what he means?" "Shh. Imagine," Jake's mother said, "imagine what a piece of work is man." It was where Jake's father went for his best material, for only 50 cents a while you wait headline that read, "Rita Hayworth leaves Ali Khan for Izzy Hirsch." It was where Jake's father bought his itching powder, metal ink spots, and the business cards which he handed out at Rivka's wedding. America, the real America, was a chance for Jake to see the cream of the Montreal Royals, Duke Snyder, Jackie Robinson, and Roy Campanella at Ebbets Field. It was Partisan Review, PM, and the New Republic. It was the liberating knowledge which struck him one day at university that he was not necessarily a freak. There were others, many more, who read and thought and felt as he did, and these others were mostly in New York. On the streets of Manhattan, where you could see them real as relations, and maybe even get to touch some, talk to others. Would commentary take him on as a copy boy, Jake thought, as he packed his suitcases and promised his mother, yes, 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 to write once a week. Or still better, he thought, as he assured his father that he really meant to find a job, he would be chatting up a cashmere-sweatered girl on Kafka in the bar at the Algonquin when the man with the gleaming bald head seated next to him would say, couldn't help overhearing, wow, have you ever opened these tired old eyes? I wonder if you'd be willing to put that down on paper for us. Us, Jake says coldly. Oh, sorry, my name's Ed Wilson. I'd like you to say hello to Dorothy here. AJ, he's the one with the Groucho mustache, EB and Harold. Or he's having a quick drink at Jack Dempsey's bar and a young Italianate man gives him a shove. Move over, Jaime. And Jake flattens him with a punch, the feared hammer of Hirsch, the very whisper of which is enough to turn champions to jelly, upsetting the Italian's middle-aged companion no end. Rocky, speak to me. My God, you've broken his jaw. He was going against Zale in the gardens tomorrow night. Now what am I going to do? Arising with the birds, the migrating birds, Jake caught the early morning train, thinking, I'm not going away. I'm heading for my spiritual home. At 10 o'clock, as they were approaching the border, the latest Italian star, even sexier than Lola Brigida, began to shed her clothes in Jake's penthouse. They've got to stop doing this, he thought. Zip, zip, then the fall of silk, no, a cascade. Ping goes the garter belt, snap goes the bra clip, and Jake, looking down at the sudden upspringing of a pup tent between his legs, hastily covered his embarrassment with Norman Vincent Peale's column and look, coughed and lit a cigarette as he was startled by a tapping on his shoulder. Yes, Jake said. An American immigration officer with a sour purple-veined face, tufts of hair curling high on his cheeks, loomed over him, sucking at a stubborn sliver of meat caught between yellowing teeth, and asked to see his birth certificate. He looked at it, grunted, scribbled Jake's name down on a pad, and waddled away, rocking with the train. 15 minutes later, he was back. You get off at the next stop, fella. What, Jake said? The desirability of your presence in the United States is suspect. The next stop will be St. Albans, Vermont. You get off there so that immigration officers can make a more thorough appraisal of your desirability, the officer said, waddling off again. Jake sat for a minute, petrified, remembering that he had signed the Stockholm Peace Appeal and a petition asking for clemency for Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Oh, you fool, you goddamn fool. Hadn't you ever heard of Senator McCarthy? Jake, having decided to go forward in search of more information, jumped up, look spilling to the train floor. He found the immigration officer seated in an empty coach, working on his teeth with the edge of a book match as he scanned a book full of names the size of a telephone directory. Why am I being taken off this train? Jake asked. You will have to make a formal application for admission to the United States at St. Albans. If you pass the examination there, you will be allowed to go to New York tonight. If not, you will be sent back to Montreal. What's this all about? Jake asked. We have reason to believe that you might be an undesirable person. What reason? I can't tell you. How long will the trial take? It's not a trial. How long will it take? As long as it does. The only reason why I asked, sir, Jake said, is today is Friday. I'm Jewish. Our Sabbath begins at sundown, and then it would be against the articles of my faith to travel. The immigration officer peered at him with fresh, and Jake dared to hope, benevolent interest. If there's anything political in this, sir, Jake said, I think it would be less than honest of me if I didn't admit that at university I was secretary of the Young Conservative Club. We arrive in St. Albans in 10 minutes. I'll meet you at the exit way to your coach. A dense downpour started just as the train was rounding into St. Albans. The immigration officer pointed at a three-story building at the top of a hill and started to climb toward it. Jake followed behind, his two suitcases bouncing off each other on his legs. He finally made it to the stone building, panting and drenched. Over the main entrance, he recognized the insignia of the U.S. Department of Justice, which he remembered from T-Man with Dennis O'Keefe. The immigration officer led Jake to the second floor landing and left him there, dripping on the brown lino, while he conferred briefly with another man. Then they continued to the third floor, where all the corridors, as far as Jake could see, were choked with filing cabinets of the small card variety. The officer asked Jake to step inside the room for a minute, politely holding the door open for him. It looked like a hospital ward. Three neatly made up double bunks and off to the left, a bathroom. Suddenly Jake heard the clang of metal behind him and whirled around to discover he was in prison. The officer went away without a word. Rain, rain, rain. A window, the bars greasy, looked out on a grubby inner courtyard. The room was clean, but impersonally done in the inevitable civil service colors. Jake lay down, deflated, on a lower bunk. HW was here, and other initials had been cut into the brown metal bedpost, and on the underside of the upper bunk, an earlier prisoner had scratched Best Mon Que Uncle Sam. Jake reached for his ballpoint pen and marked a one on the wall for the first day. Then he pressed his ear against the wall, which was pleasurably cold, just in case an urgent message was being tapped out to him. Actually, there was a radio transmitter in the room next to his. It crackled and squawked as the operator rasped out messages to border agents. Watch out for Anagafopoulos. Anagafopoulos, A as in Abel, N as in, yeah, he's a Greek. He's expected to try to enter from Montreal in a party of full 40 roller skaters. Outside Jake's room, male and female clerks passed again and again without showing any interest in him. They seemed to be forever opening and kneeing shut metal files. Whir, pause, clang. Whir, pause, clang. Hear this, the radio operator said. We expect those baby smugglers to make another crossing in 2 days. So let's get with it, eh, fellas? At noon, the janitor looked in and asked if he could get Jake some lunch. Jake gave the man a dollar, and an hour later he came back with sandwiches and cigarettes. Next, the immigration officer returned, unlocked the door, and pointed his chewed-out pencil at Jake's head. No hat, he said. What? Jake said. I know about Jews. Read up about them in Life magazine once. You're eating without a hat, so you'd travel after sundown too, wouldn't you, fellow? You're very observant, Jake said. I'm sure one day Edgar Hoover will take notice. The immigration officer led Jake out of the building and across town to a rambling boxcar brown clapboard unit that had been set up alongside the tracks. Jake followed the officer's shiny trouser seat up the wooden stairs to an office with four desks and a pot-bellied stove where somebody else sat. Hair parted straight down the middle, dead eyes, almost no lips, and a slightly soiled shirt collar curling at the edges. One heart-sinking glance and Jake knew he was done for. His questioner was a type well known to him. Exceed the speed limit by 2 miles and he was waiting on a motorcycle right round the bend. Light up in a department store and he stepped out of nowhere to point at the no smoking sign. Full name, the round-shouldered man asked. Age, 20, Jake said. Father's full name, place of birth, religion, Jewish. Employer, none, Jake said. Uh-huh. Have you ever belonged to any of the following organizations? I'll read them over slowly. The Young Communist League. I should say not, Jake said. Friends of the Spanish Civil War Refugees. The League of Canadian Consumers. Students for Peace. I'd like to make a statement, Jake said. The round-shouldered man leaned back in a swiveled chair and cracked his knuckles. The immigration officer took off his hat and scratched his head. One of my enemies at the university, Jake said, used to sign my name to left-wing petitions. What's his name? It was a joke, Jake said. He thought it was a funny thing to do. I see. Did you belong to the Progressive Book Club? 1 minute, Jake said. Let me think. I'm not sure. The Progressive Book Club. Yes or no? Yes, Jake said. Next, the man read out a seemingly endless list of newspapers and magazines and asked Jake if he had ever subscribed to any of them. All of Jake's replies were typed out in quintuplet, and then he was asked to check his answers for inaccuracies and misspellings before he signed each copy. It says here, Jake said, religion Hebrew. I clearly remember saying Jewish. So what, the man said. He's a fresh guy, the immigration officer said. I warned you. I'm sure, Jake said, you wouldn't want me to sign a false statement. Uh-huh. There are higher courts than this, Jake said. Christ Almighty, but you believe in making things tough for yourself. Okay, I'll write in Jewish over Hebrew. You initial each copy where I've done that. Roger, Jake said, winking. Now listen here, kid, you cut that out. Jake signed the copies, then he was fingerprinted and brought back to the office. This hearing is now closed, the man said, because you are considered undesirable to the United States. Your application for admission has been refused, and you are temporarily excluded under the provisions of Section 235C of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952. You will be returned to Montreal this evening at 7:30. You still haven't given me a reason, Jake said. We are not authorized to divulge information on which we pass exclusion. This time, Jake was driven back to his place of detention, where he was immediately sick to his stomach in the toilet. Oh, God, he thought, how could this happen to me? Why? Exhausted, he fell asleep and wakened 2 hours later to find that there was a thin, middle-aged man with a sunken pot belly perched on the edge of the upper bunk opposite him, spindly legs dangling in midair. The man was wearing a natty straw hat and a checked shirt at least two sizes too large for him and split running shoes. He had enormous pop eyes, opened, it seemed, in an attitude of perpetual amazement, and he held a walking stick over his head. Don't move, he said, shaking his stick at Jake. Not an inch closer. Jesus Christ, Jake said, who are you? As if you didn't know. Jake began to sit up tentatively. The man, watchful, didn't protest. I knew they'd send somebody, he said. Jake stared, frightened. Cockroach, the man said. Vermin, that's you. Would you mind telling me what this is all about? Jake asked. Admit it. Fagelbaum's paying. Sure, Jake said. Or is it Shapiro? The man asked. Nobody's paying. Nobody sent me here. I'm a prisoner. I'm being sent to Montreal tonight. To keep tabs on me, the man said. That's right, Jake said. Well, I'm on to you, human trash. If you so much as reach into your pocket for a weapon, I'll scream for the guards. I'm unarmed, Jake said. Don't make me laugh. I'll stand up with my arms over my head and you search me. Oh, no, you don't. That's when I get the judo chop. Why would I want to kill you? Jake asked. For the money, for the $5 million. Dollars, Jake said. American, the man said. Jake whistled. Didn't they tell you that much? The man asked. I'm not completely trusted, Jake said. They'd stop at nothing to put me out of the way, and you know that. My case is before the Supreme Court in Manhattan right now, calendar number 33451-1953. I wish you luck, Jake said. It was my father's money. It belongs to me. I know where Fagelbaum is, and I've located Shapiro, but I still have to find Zucker. The man's eyes, to Jake's astonishment, appeared to open even wider. They might actually pop, he thought. I'm willing to share the money with anyone who helps me recover it, the man said, and bring the criminals to justice. Cigarette, Jake asked. Not one of yours, thank you. Are you crazy? Surely you don't think my cigarettes are poisoned. Last time Fagelbaum tried to murder me, it was with supersonic rays. They paralyze and destroy the bodily organs. They're not trying to kill me themselves, no siree. Instead, they hire people to try for them, human excrement like you. Honestly, Jake said, nobody sent me. Tell Fagelbaum this. I have witnesses among the paid hirelings who have used these supersonic waves on me and who will testify to it in court. I'll pass on the message, Jake said, I promise. Tears welled in the old man's eyes. His hands shook. I can't do anything. I can't go anywhere, he said. Once a dentist I went to in New York City injected me with what he called a local anesthetic. Sure. It was a drug causing eye illness which leads to blindness. Wherever I live, microphones and radar are installed so that everything I write, everything I read, every movement I make can be seen and heard. Do you think they can hear us here? Jake asked. Now, don't be childish. Even outside on the street, every movement I make is spotted on the radar. Someone is always after me. Even when I go into a telephone booth, they pick up my conversation with a microphone in their pocket. They have complete control over every movement I make. This goes for my mail also. They look through my mail. Nearly all my mail, except registered certified, is stolen from my post office box. Suddenly, a metal clipboard was banged against the door, and a man peered in the barred window. What did you say your mother's maiden name was? He asked Jake. I already told you, Jake said. The middle-aged man leaped down from his bed and threw himself against the door. "You've got to get me out of here. I'm not like him. We want the name again." "He was put in here to murder me," the man said. "He's a hired killer. The name, please." "It's on the form," Jake said. "You've got it right there. Spell it for me, will you?" Jake spelled it for him. "You can go now," the man said. "Train time." Jake picked up a suitcase. "What about him?" he asked. "Don't put me on the same train," the man said, retreating. "Please." "Don't worry, Grandpa. Someone's coming for you." The man slid to the floor, holding his head in his hands, and began to sob. "Can't you do anything for him?" Jake asked, exasperated. "Got any ideas?" The door was shut behind Jake, and he was led downstairs and put in the care of another officer, a young plainclothes man with a clean, crisp feel about him and a most disarming smile. The young man immediately stooped to relieve Jake of one of his suitcases. It was a small gesture, done without fuss, but the kindness of it all touched Jake, and it occurred to him for the first time that he was sweaty and rumpled, and that in the eyes of this pleasant young man, he must seem a small-time con artist, or maybe even a nut, like the man Jake had left behind. After such a long day's squalor, the young man came as a shock to Jake. He looked so wholesome, such a good credit risk. As Jake and the young man stepped outside together in the fresh air, he dared to hope that passers-by would take them for friends, not a prisoner and his guard, and he was filled with the need to dissociate himself from the day's seediness and make a good impression. "Pardon my asking," the young man said, "but you're a political, aren't you?" "Well, yes," Jake said. "I mean, that's the charge." "I don't mind the politicals. They're educated and are really, well, idealistic, sort of. It's the drug addicts and the homosexuals that I find so degrading. Or do you think of them as sick?" Jake shrugged. "What were you going to do in New York?" "Overthrow the government by force," Jake said. "That's rich. That's a good one. Me," Jake said, "and my little supersonic ray gun." "You were put in with him then. Now, isn't that man something, a real case?" "I'll say," Jake said. "You with the FBI? "Hell no, nothing like that," the young man said, grinning. "Say, I must tell you how much I admire things Canadian. In our house, we always watch CBC TV. It doesn't insult your intelligence, if you know what I mean. They allow for nonconformists, like that Professor McAllister, who sometimes debates on foreign affairs." Brian McAllister, Jake remembered, lectured on economics at McGill, a tiresome, literal socialist. "Would you know McAllister?" the young man asked, "personally, coming from Montreal?" "No," Jake said. "They said somebody was coming for the old man. Who?" "Oh, him. Hell, we've had him 3 times already. His son, I suppose. He's a very distinguished dentist. Say, did the old boy show you the numbers on his arm?" "The numbers?" "No," Jake said, beginning to feel the nausea rising in him again. "Cigarette?" "No, thanks," Jake said. "The Dodgers are going with Erskine tomorrow. The old professor is going to put in Whitey Ford." Jake nodded. "When the train pulls in, you just get on ahead of me. No need to embarrass you, is there?" "What numbers?" Jake said. "What are you talking about, you goddamn fool?" "It was something they did to them during the war," the young man said, "in concentration camps. Didn't you know that?" Jake glared at the young man, full of self-loathing because he had wanted to ingratiate himself with him, and suppressed an urge to hit him with his suitcase. "The irony of it is," the young man said, "that now some of those same Germans are back in office in Western Germany. Now, what do you say to that?" "Kiss my Royal Canadian ass," Jake said. "Be friendly. Come on. There's nothing personal in this." He offered Jake a cigarette, and this time Jake took it. "Off the record," the young man said, "I'd even say there was something to it." "To what?" Jake said. "What are you talking about now? Concentration camps? The World Series? Is everybody crazy in this country?" The young man stopped, his pleasant face aching with high seriousness. "Would you say that?" "That, this, what are you talking about?" Jake said. "Communism, the original idea of brotherhood. Well, I buy it," the man said. "But you can't make it work. It rubs against human nature." Jake stared at the tracks, willing the train into the station. "I suppose," the young man said, "some of your buddies were going to meet you in New York. A parade was planned," Jake said, "a big demonstration. Can I phone anybody for you to explain why you didn't turn up?" "I'm going to be sick," Jake said. "I've got to sit down." Jake slumped against a pillar. Here comes the train. You just get on ahead of me. We don't need to sit together. The young man settled in 5 seats behind Jake, and when they reached the border, he got up and jumped off the train. Jake caught his eye as he stood on the platform, lighting up. The young man waved. His face broke into an infectious grin. Jake's heart thumped crazily. His head was pounding, and to his own amazement, he spit venomously on the window just as the train lurched backwards, vibrated, and jerked forward again. The young man looked at him, shaking his head, appalled. And Jake, consumed with shame, realized he had done it again, shown himself one of the oily ones, an off-white. He had done the wrong and childish thing, made a fool of himself when hitherto all the right had been on his side. So that when he remembered this day and came to talk about it at dinner parties years later, he would recall with stinging freshness his stupid spit on the window. But he would always leave that out of the story, except when he told it to Nancy. Back in Montreal, Jake made straight for the bar in Central Station, ordered a double whiskey, and paid for it with American money. Montreal is the Paris of North America, the waiter said. I trust you will enjoy your stay, sir. Jake stared at his change. What's this, he asked, Monopoly money? It's Canadian, the waiter said. Jake laughed, pleased. Canada's no joke, the waiter said. We're the world's leading producer of uranium. Walter Pidgeon was born in this country.
As we mentioned at the beginning of this evening, if we'll give Mr. Richler a moment to light up his cigar. I understand that there's no smoking allowed, but we'll allow him to smoke his cigar at the risk of all of us being thrown out. If there's anyone that would like to begin by asking a question, we'll be glad to recognize them.
So would I. I'm sorry, I'm working on it. Probably for another year.
Yes. Could you perhaps stand so that your voice would probably carry somewhat better?
I'm not sure I quite understand your question. All this world disappeared some time ago. It doesn't. I see. Oh, do you want me to? Sure.
I think it would be best if Mr. Richler stands, so that if you would like to speak or ask questions, please raise your hand and he'll recognize you.
Did you ever think of writing about Hutchison Street?
You're not serious, are you? You're not being serious, are you? I hope so, yeah.
Of course, I want your progress. You're going to leave your audience behind you.
I'll take the risk.
Oh. Well, I work every day, like just about anybody else. Well, I work for a few hours every day, yeah. I think it's time another idea hit me. Yeah, it's more like that. Yes, I am.
Sorry, what do you think about the novelist as a politician? Do you have any sort of grandiose ideas for creating identity? Or do you just write as you write as you write?
Well, the novelist shouldn't be or isn't a politician, really. But you're only a novelist when you sit down and work at it. The rest of the time, like you, I'm a citizen and a husband and a father and all sorts of things. And of course, I'm interested in politics. But I don't think it's the stuff of fiction. So I'm politically committed only in so much as I live here in this time and plays, but not. I don't think fiction should be bent to those uses, really. One writes articles about that sort of thing. Yes? I'm sorry, I can't hear. I wouldn't bother.
Richard, why should you be accused of being anti-Semitic? Why? You say don't bother. Surely you have a duty.
A duty to what?
To make a reply. But why should you be accused of being anti-Semitic? I heard the young lady, and I've had occasion to hear other comments or read comments. Why? Why should you be accused?
Well, it's...
You don't have a gift, you solely pretend, a satire. You tear away the veil, you expose, you reveal. But at the same time, you have hurt feelings.
Well, these accusations are...
And I say that you have a duty to justify...
Oh, I recognize my duties, sir. I recognize my duties.
Well, you just said that you...
This sort of accusation is only made... by very coarse people, I find. And I don't take part in that kind of dialogue. Does that answer your...
No, I didn't hear your answer at all.
You didn't hear?
I heard you say something about coarse, but I don't...
I said this nature of accusation, I find, is only made by very coarse people, and I don't take part in that sort of dialogue.
I've heard specific comments. I read. And I have yet to find or to hear of any answer about you. You are above and clear. You have a duty.
Where have you read this? What I don't know what kind of... I'd hate to guess what kind of publications you read. Well, I think you should be specific. It might help.
I could, if you want.
Yes.
Richard, we don't think of writers and poets in the same way as we think of, let's say, members of tailors and manufacturers and so on. We think of them, and although it's true that people in the professions can be creative, and although manufacturers and industrialists certainly are creative, we somehow don't feel that in terms of human potential and in terms of creativity of the intellect and emotion, and that which remains forever, that which adds to human values and cultural values. We don't think of them as doing anything in that field. We think of writers, of poets, of artists, of musicians working in that towards that goal. Assuming that may be partially correct, would you feel that authors and poets have a social mission or do have a conscious or even unconscious mission in life, whereby they want to leave the world a little better aware of itself. Permit the world to progress towards that idea.
The only mission or duty an artist has is to be true to his own vision, and the rest is peripheral. Which is, you know, as clearly as I can put it. No, no, it's
a matter of
saying things as honestly as he can.
But it would appear that a journalist is not expected to be able to say it as well, and in a classical way, or in a permanent form, is not able to reduce that to a permanent form, whereas a, let us say, novelist is. Now, is the only distinction that exists between journalists, let's say, and novelists, that of technique, or that of the form in which they attempt to embody or incorporate this vision?
Well, you know, there are a lot of distinctions to be made between journalism and fiction. I do both. Let's say journalism deals with the grammar of human experience, and fiction deals with the essences. I guess that's a good distinction. I'm not that interested in Montreal Jewry, to tell you the truth. You seem to fasten on some sort of intricate relationship between me and this community. This is where I mine the art. It's not necessarily my audience. I write about many things. About Montreal among them, or the Montreal I knew. But I have other preoccupations and concerns that run as deep. You know, I've lived away from here for 18 years now, or almost that. I like to think I have a certain loyalty to my past. That's something else. I haven't got one. I haven't got one.
If you study sociology, you know there are many images.
I don't study sociology.
You're what I would call a pragmatic sociologist.
That's a presumption.
Otherwise, you couldn't write about Suburban Street. You have to be. Judging by what you read tonight, you are a pragmatic sociologist. You're not voicing theory, but you are voicing a lot of pragmatic formulations. Now, you must have some idea of yourself. A writer, your place in society, your relationship, for instance, to other writers, say Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, a man who wrote, ten, 12 years ago, forget his name. How do you relate yourself to American authors, Canadian authors? Because you have a very special image. There's only one Mordecai Richmond. You stand out, there's no doubt about it. Some agree with you, some hate you. Some affirm you by the, judging by the applause here, or they worship you. So give us an idea how you visualize yourself. You almost have a little truth.
This lady wants to come to your defense, I think, or something.
I have to think that that's a very unfair question to ask an artist of any kind, whether it's a painter, a poet, or a writer. I mean, how would you like to be up there and expose yourself to so many people?
Just
talking about you might not have one. He happens to be talking about something called art. He's not talking about himself as a person.
Still, I think that Mr. Richard can pretty well take care of himself. I want to thank you, though, for making the call.
I don't believe in offering explanations for my work. I think it speaks for itself, you know. And that's why I'd like to leave it.
Self-appraisal.
You want to know my credit rating? Is that?
I thought I saw it. In.
Oh, yes. No, I don't feel that so. I do feel, though, that young men and women 10 years younger than I am are more interested in film at the moment. That's true. But no, I don't think the novel is as seen its day now.
Yes.
I see a number of similarities in the characters of Billy Kravitz and Noah Adler. And I'm wondering, have the stories around these characters having anything to do with specific incidents in your early life here in Montreal?
Well, they both come from the same time and place, don't they? And naturally, I do draw on experiences I've had or my knowledge of that area, which might account for a vast number of similarities, yes. Well, I wouldn't be interested in writing the same thing again or same thing twice. So naturally, I hope anything I write is always different, you know, or seen from a different perspective. Yes. Diddy Kravitz is not a standard bearer, was not a standard bearer for the Jewish life in Montreal or anywhere. It was the creation of a character. And that's the way I saw it. And that's the way I thought it had to be.
Which authors have influenced you the most? And why?
Well, I guess the consensus here would be Alfred Rosenberg, I was, as a young writer, fancied people like Malraux and Sartre and very dramatic continental writers. I do think that Evelyn Waugh was the greatest novelist of our time, if that's... I admire Nathaniel West, and there are a lot of contemporary young writers whose work, you know, I read with pleasure.
Who are your favorite contemporaries?
Well, I'd rather not answer that, if you don't mind.
On what
grounds?
Might incriminate.
But some of these people are my friends.
Yes.
Mr. Rich, how interested were you in literature when you were in high school? And did you then know that you would end up being a novelist?
I thought I was going to be a great snooker player. No, I was not very interested.
Yes?
Did you only really feel that you could develop your career by writing outside of Canada rather than writing here? I mean, I know you're doing it now, but when you started.
Well, I wanted to leave. I was very bored here. And I wanted to go to Europe, which is a very romantic thing, you know, when you're 20. I'm not saying that someone could not stay here and write better work. It was a personal, it's not a program for writers, you know, it was a personal choice. Yes, I'm sure, yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Richter, what's your experience being this writer in residence in church? What is your strategy? Did you follow in the course? The creative, I guess,
the
interest
in
how creative do you find?
Well, actually, the nature of the job is that it really is a fellowship, and they allow you. Just about all your time to get on with your own work. I go in one afternoon a week and take a class, a sort of writer's workshop. It's the first time I've done it. I don't really believe these things can be taught, so I'm not a convinced teacher of writing at all.
You criticize the
work. That's right, yeah. I'm sorry? Well, it's not something I do particularly well. I think possibly other people can do that. Sort of
yes.
If I could direct from your book seems to be a flashback, are you going away from the democratic
style
and the realistic to
a
different time?
Well, I'm very superstitious about talking about a work in progress. In fact, I very seldom even read from it. So I'd rather not discuss the nature of the, if you don't mind. Sorry.
How did you first come to start writing a book?
Got a typewriter in your paper? I'm sorry? I wanted to write, and the way some people want to be shoemakers or dentists or. I wanted to be a writer.
You weren't interested in literature and
studying? No, I said to this gentleman that at a time in my life I wasn't.
Did you find it was easier to publish in Europe than it was in North America?
No. I at that time I certainly did not want a Canadian publisher, and I chose to have my works published, as I still do. They come from London and New York. And no, I just like living there.
You certainly describe a generation gap in your novels. These are angry young men. Can you see a continuity between this generation gap in your novels, back 20 years or so, and the present generation? Are we dealing perhaps with the same problem, but now it's being acted out, and the hostility is externalized against society? Rather than the way you describe?
I really don't know enough about that. I can't speak with any. It's just gossip, if I. Yes? Sorry.
I wouldn't want to ask
you
to give any assessment of your own words, but.
But you're going to. Yeah, go ahead.
Writers and other artists are affecting any sort of
Why expect them to affect change? I don't. When have they been expected to affect change? There are very few books of any kind that have, or novels that have affected. There's Zola. I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well. But it has nothing to do with affecting social change. Or I don't think the arts are that important, if you really want to know. I'm interested. I've even got a selfish interest. But I don't think they're that important. I think we can easily live without it.
If I may, just for a moment, use my prerogative as chairman. You mentioned that you have a vision. And a gentleman says to you, well, fine, if you have a vision, your vision is probably for a better society, or
no?
What is your vision then?
2020.
You can't even give your brother any business then.
No, it has to. Has to do with being loyal to the window you look out of, you see, not compromising your writing for any markets or for any unimportant reason. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, but I don't believe you.
Okay. Yes.
And if you're interested in writing something that is the truth, then obviously all you have to do is to look around you and see hypocrisy, falseness being lived out every day. And so if you want to present vision for truth, then obviously.
Yes, but these are not, like, if one wanted to affect social change, you'd go into politics, wouldn't you? I mean, they're different levels of action, and most writers are not men of action at all.
You mean to say that people like in our day, of our generation, Pierre Dos Passos and Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis and people like that did not have a vision of some kind of social change, of a desire for a better kind of world, and that they were, in their writings, they were affected by this sort of thing?
Well, Upton Sinclair had some meat laws changed. It was very influential. No, I'm serious. It's true. Yes, and he wrote a book about this. No, it's very serious. That's quite true.
All right. So that's something that we bring sort of back to a conclusion.
Yeah.
But don't you think that there was a wider vision involved in these people and many others that we don't need to mention, that we're both familiar with? Surely Ernest Hemingway had a vision, and others.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah. What about George Rich? Is he here? The Labour Party in Britain. What about George Rich?
Well, he was a Labourite before they even knew that they ever had a chance.
Look, I try to make it clear that I think writers, like everyone else, are active in politics. But hopefully the books don't deal with legislation and reforms of that kind, are concerned with the human condition, you know, on a different level. I don't mean I think writing a book is a moral act and is a measure of concern. And if society were perfect, there'd probably be fewer books written. But I pity the writer who thinks he's going to affect social changes through his work. Well, you have a lot of literature of political action, or I wouldn't say literature, but writing of political action now being written by American Negro writers, which is very close to a kind of Jewish American writing of the 30s. But we're now much more critical of Clifford Odets and a lot of people who wrote in the 30s. And what's remained is Henry Roth and Nathaniel West and people who are not part of that game, and somehow their works seem more important. Now, if you want to know what it was like in Russia during the revolution, you don't read Ilya Ehrenberg, you read Isaac Babel, and that's what I'm talking about.
There's a gentleman there.
You let down to there. I also let down to there.
I don't remember you. Yeah.
So I don't know what is it. I read the Son of a Small Hero, for instance, and now you read parts of your book, and I still see that you concentrate on the negative parts. You only see the nouveau riche, or those that want to get rich. You didn't see those that wanted to build, for instance, Israel, or those that went to Spain and afterwards fought in the World War and sacrificed themselves in order that people now should get unemployment insurance, all kinds of social medicine, etc. I don't see them. You only see the negative facts among them.
Yeah, well, you're also good at seeing the positive side. What do you I don't accept that, really. Possibly, I'm sorry? That's right, yeah. Yeah.
But both to us Jews and naturally to non-Jews, we don't sound the same as I know we have negative side, we have negative side. But actually we have quite a number of problems that we didn't notice.
I'm not finished yet.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I asked this gentleman.
That won't be a long time. If I understood you correctly, you said that your obligation, it is your obligation as a writer to be honest. May I address a question to this honesty here? Certainly, you must have known that some of the words that you have written will create a great deal of controversy. We also know that any publicity is good publicity, and the more...
Well, let me stop you right there. First of all, I'm not in the publicity business one way or another. Let me stop you one moment. And then the only place where my work creates this kind of controversy is in this small parochial community in Montreal. It does not create this sort of controversy in England or New York or even Toronto.
No, I did not make that statement.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I want to extend this question a little further.
Okay. Mm. No, but I just, go ahead, okay.
Now, as I was to say that, any controversy is some sort of publicity and promotion, it does help. Now, can you honestly say, as I have addressed this question to your honesty, can you honestly say that you have said at that time to yourself, well, I don't care whether it will create any controversy or not, as long as I feel like I've written what I have to write? Or would you say, has it ever occurred to you, honestly, and say, well, if it does create some controversy, the better for the book and the more it will do for this work
than
anyone?
The answer is no. That's right, yeah. I'm very economical.
Sir.
Mr. Richler, I know almost nothing about you or your writing, and I've noticed a certain amount of presumptions made on the part of us, the audience. Do you have any way of telling us why you write, what motivates you as a person to write, why are you writing?
Well, I enjoy it. Well, it's rather more complicated, but that's for openers. I really couldn't answer that in a satisfactory way. I guess it's what I feel I need to do. And it's what I enjoy most.
Have you ever thought of leaving the profession, doing anything else?
Are you offering me a job?
No, I thought maybe you had something to bring you back to it.
What have you got in mind? I don't know what you mean. What, leaving it for what? Well, I have doubts every day about what I'm doing, yeah. I have doubts every day about what I'm doing. Like, well, there's scotch, and there's all sorts of things. No, I mean, I just go on doing what I need to do. Yes?
Yes.
Oh. Do I enjoy my what? I don't sort of knew more about the economics of magazine writing in Canada. It could hardly be bread and butter, so it would have to be done for enjoyment.
Well, you seem to think I thoroughly enjoy it, but you seem to get a lot of things off your chest with me.
You've been listening to a historic recording from the Jewish Public Library in Montreal, brought to you by the Francis Brandt Yiddish Audio Library at the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. The restored recording is copyright 2012 by the Jewish Public Library of Montreal and the National Yiddish Book Center. Project coordinator at the Yiddish Book Center is Jordan Kutzik. Digitization and restoration are by Paul Adams of Mass Productions in Woburn, Massachusetts. Our theme music is by Hankus Netsky. For additional recordings in the Brandt Yiddish Audio Library, please visit us online at www.yiddishbookcenter.org. A shenem dank. Thanks for listening.